This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
KBOO Radio from 5:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. this coming Wednesday on 90.7 FM and also heard on the web at kboo.fm.
And get together, break up this old Jim Crow. Break it up now.
Hi, this is Per Fogring, host of Fight the Empire. Thursday, I'll be talking with film director Oliver Stone and historian Peter Kuznick. Together, they have produced a 10-part television series and a 700-page book called The Untold History of the United States. That's Thursday, January 17th at 9:30 a.m. A talk with Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick on KBOO, your radio station.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, opening statements begin in the trial of Mohammed Mohammed, the alleged Christmas tree bomber.
Portland activists join in an international day in support of the Canadian Indigenous Rights Movement, Idle No More.
Portland City Council announces plans to end the policy allowing apartment buildings without parking lots.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, January 11, 2013. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Liam Delta. The Portland City Council heard 2 hours of testimony yesterday on whether to change a city policy that allows the construction of huge apartment buildings without parking. The half mile of Southeast Division Street between 32nd and 39th Avenues has become the center of the controversy. Current residents are organizing to oppose a planned 320 new units with no parking included. They worry that the new residents will overcrowd the already busy streets with parked cars. KBOO's Joe Meyer was at the council session and filed this report.
Portland City Council met yesterday and took public testimony regarding the city's policy of allowing apartments without parking. Although this planning regulation passed in the 1980s, it wasn't until recently that market forces conspired to make such developments pencil out. The mayor seems ready to rein this in.
So is the current Portland City policy towards apartments with no parking a good growth direction or needs to be tweaked?
It does need to be adjusted. It needs to be tweaked because we didn't see this kind of scale of the problem coming. We didn't believe that people would build large projects with no parking. So it's happening. It's real. Change happens. And we need to respond to that. But we're also hearing from the community, I think, a very thoughtful and balanced understanding that we are going to accommodate growth in our city. There are going to be different kinds of housing built than the kind that we each might live in. But we've still got to make it work, and we've got to have a livable city when it's all unpacked.
What are some of the fundamental trade-offs that you see?
Well, it does cost money to include parking in a project. You either use up land that could have apartments on it, or you build very expensive concrete structures that house cars. And when we do that, we impose a cost on that new development. And that cost is worth it in this case, I think, up to a point, because we also have to make sure that each project adds to the livability of the neighborhood, doesn't erode it.
In that regard, did you see any specific proposals today that you like?
I did. I think this idea of a basic minimum ratio of somewhere around a quarter or a third or a half of a space per unit makes sense to me. Let's try that for a while. Let's see how that works. In effect, we've been trying a ratio of zero for a while, and we've found out that that doesn't really work. So it's okay to experiment a little bit if we're nimble enough to look at this again a year from now and maybe have to make some more adjustments. I'd rather get it right the first time, but we can always adjust.
If we want a 20-minute neighborhood, don't we need to require some kind of amenities, some kind of commercial amenities for neighbors?
Yeah, I think we need to look, and this is probably more of a matter for this longer-term review of the comprehensive plan, how much of the city are we zoning for mixed-use development, or how much of it are we zoning for one kind of development, either commercial or housing? I think mixed-use is a great concept, and we see how lively it makes streets like Belmont or now Vancouver and Williams Avenues. So it's a powerful tool to make urban places. We might not be using it enough yet, and we might have too much old-style zoning that says this should just be storefront buildings for hardware stores, those kinds of neighborhood businesses, or just apartment buildings. The mixture is pretty cool, and it gets us a great result at street level.
That was Portland Mayor Charlie Hales. The city code allowing apartments with no parking needs a quick update. I spoke with Commissioner Nick Fish earlier today for an update on council direction.
We had a hearing yesterday, and there's obviously some unforeseen impacts on neighborhoods that we have to address. And so I fully support the approach which the council is going to take, which is to fast-track some changes that address parking requirements and from my point of view, also address saturation ahead of the update of the comprehensive plan.
How do you see jurisdiction in this case? You know, what's wrong with the developer making some money? He's got a windfall. You know, why can the city step in, or how should the city step in?
The question is, how do we balance this development boom with the quality of life in our neighborhoods? That is a council concern. I think you're seeing the council address it seriously and expeditiously. And my guess is that within the next 2 or 3 months, we'll have some legislation that that provides a short-term fix to the issues that have been identified. And then we'll look at this more holistically through the update of the comprehensive plan.
I think through discussion you initiated yesterday, it became clear that any kind of windfall will probably not result in lower rents.
Well, the question I asked yesterday was, following Joe Zender's comment that there was a premium built into rents when there was parking, I asked him if we were also seeing a discount in rents where there was no parking. And his sense was that the market was driving the pricing with or without parking.
So it seems like most of it, we're talking about market rates. So there's going to be some kind of windfall for the developer, if we want to call it that or not, to do some extra profit. Is it appropriate that the city takes some of that money and appropriates it directly for affordable housing?
Well, we have an existing program, which a lot of these buildings would be eligible for, which is our tax abatement programs.
Right. So it seems like your way is a carrot. You know, is there a stick?
We're preempted on a lot of tools, as you know, by the legislature. But I'm particularly interested in the carrot, in incentive programs which encourage developers to have family-friendly units, affordable units, units that are accessible to older adults and the like, but to do it through positive incentives.
That was Housing Commissioner Nick Fish. Within the next few months, Portland will stop allowing apartments without parking. And this is Joe Meyer with KBOO News.
$266,000 has been raised so far to benefit victims of the Clackamas Town shooting. Donations to the Clackamas County Benevolent Peace Officers Foundation ranged from four $1 bills to one anonymous corporate donation of $250,000. $10,000 will be spent on crisis response programs for the Clackamas Police and Mall Security. The two victims' families, as well as a 15-year-old girl wounded in the attack, will each receive $80,000 from the fund. Anyone wishing to donate may contribute by mail or in person at a Clackamas County Federal Credit Union.
A school district in rural Ohio plans to arm their janitors as a response to recent school shootings. The Montpelier School District Board voted Wednesday night to allow four custodians to begin carrying weapons on school grounds. Yesterday, the district superintendent announced the decision as a way to, quote, beef up school security, unquote. The cleaning staff will be required to pass a 2-day firearms course in March before the policy takes effect. Today, Texas Lieutenant Governor David Dewhurst called for state funding for firearms for teachers and school administrators. On Wednesday, LaGrand, Oregon, Police Chief Brian Harvey spoke to his local school board about ways to prevent further school shootings. Chief Harvey recommended that the Eastern Oregon School District either install armed police officers in every school or adopt a policy allowing faculty and staff to carry concealed weapons. According to LaGrand Superintendent Larry Glaze, armed guards would cost over $250,000 a year and would force the district to cut teaching positions. It is legal under Oregon law for concealed carry permit holders to bring weapons onto school grounds. Chief Harvey said that the local police and sheriff's departments have offered to provide training and assistance. School board member John Sprenger worried about the potential liability issues and wondered if, quote, the cure might be worse than the illness, unquote.
Today marks an International Day of Action to support the Idle No More movement for Indigenous rights in Canada. Hundreds of actions took place around the world led by Indigenous activists and supporters. The Day of Action was held to coincide with meetings held between First Nation leaders and Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper. The meeting focused on a proposed new bill that Indigenous leaders say violates their right to self-governance and control of traditional land bases. But some of the leaders of the Idle No More movement, including a grandmother on day 34 of a hunger strike, boycotted today's meeting, saying that it will not change hundreds of years of injustices. In Portland, a flash mob was held this afternoon at 3 p.m. in Pioneer Square in downtown Portland. KBOO's Jenka Soderbergh spoke by phone with one of the organizers during the event today.
I am joined on the line now by KBOO reporter Robin Ryan, who is on the scene at the Idle No More flash mob. Robin, can you describe the scene there right now?
Yes, we have a crowd of somewhere between 150, 200, maybe more. There is currently a song going on in the drum circle. They've had a speech. And I have Shiloh George, who is one of the organizers of the event, and I'm going to put her on with you.
I wonder if you could introduce yourself and tell us what brought you out today.
Hi, my name is Shiloh George, and I am Southern Cheyenne Arapaho, and I'm a Portland State University graduate student. And I'm really inspired by this movement, especially looking at it and watching it as it unfolded. And I've been doing a lot of work in our Indigenous community here in Portland and on decolonization work through Portland State and the Indigenous Nation Studies program. And so to see this movement emerge out of Canada and spread so quickly around the globe has just ignited a new fire in me to continue the work that I'm doing and continuing working as a community. And it's just so inspiring. And I hear that from so many people that, you know, I think sometimes we sort of get stuck in the work that we're doing, and this just sort of ignited our fire again, and it's just feeding this new momentum.
What are some of the main demands of the Idle No More movement?
So out of Canada, they're wanting nation-to-nation relations and looking at the treaties and upholding the treaties and also being stewards of the land, really concerned about ecological disasters and mining, fracking, and oil, taking oil from the land on reserves. The Bill C-45, which has already gone through the Canadian government, weakens treaty rights for lots of their Indigenous people, their First Nations people, and so they want the government to repeal that. So it's nation-to-nation relationships, ecological concerns, and also a new resurgence of culture and sovereignty within First Nations as well as global Indigenous peoples.
And what are the next steps? You mentioned the potential for teach-ins. Are there any of those currently scheduled?
Yes, we do have a teach-in scheduled for January 24th. It's a Thursday, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the Native American Student and Community Center on the PSU campus. And we're going to be presenting some background information on Idle No More and how it started. And then we're going to be talking about the Coalition of Communities of Color. They did a research study, I think it was about a year and a half to 2 years ago, on Native Americans in Multnomah County. And it was a pretty unsettling profile of the state of our community here, urban Indian community here in Multnomah County. And so we're going to be discussing that and where we can go from here. And also, I think we're really interested in knowing what people want to learn about. I've heard a lot of supporters and allies who are non-Indigenous who would like to learn about how they can be supportive and helpful and what ways that they can be our allies. So there's a number of teach-ins we could do. So I'm really interested in knowing also what people would like to learn about.
Well, thanks so much. Again, we've been speaking with one of the organizers of the Idle No More rally, speaking to us from the round dance itself. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Yamasi. Thank you so much.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Newly released confidential documents show that the city of Portland has been negotiating with Nike since last summer to build an office in the South Waterfront District. The secret negotiations between Nike and the city, and also the state, have led to widespread criticism of special treatment for the Beaverton-based sportswear giant. This came to a head in late December when Governor Kitzhaber called a special session of the legislature to provide Nike with special tax incentives for the next 40 years. Secret documents related to that deal showed that the state officials had been in talks with Nike since last summer, but that Nike had required the governor to sign a non-disclosure agreement to keep quiet about the terms of their agreement. The city of Portland had to sign a similar agreement. The Oregonian newspaper filed multiple Freedom of Information requests to find out the content of the non-disclosure agreements, but the requests were denied because the city said the documents were exempt from public records laws. But yesterday, the city agreed to release the documents, which revealed a plan to construct new offices for Nike in the South Waterfront District.
A jury was selected today in the trial of Mohammed Mohammed, the young man suspected of attempting to detonate a car bomb at Portland's 2010 Christmas tree lighting ceremony. Mohammed is charged with attempting to ignite a weapon of mass destruction. The device was, in fact, a fake rigged by the FBI. The defense argues that federal agents entrapped Mohammed, making him legally not responsible for his actions. Seating the 12 jurors and four alternates took a day and a half, leaving time for opening statements this afternoon. KBOO's Joe Meyer attended the trial today and joins us live now to describe what happened. Joe, can you set the scene at the trial in the federal courthouse for us?
Sure, Linda. What was real interesting being there is at 1000 Southwest 3rd in downtown Portland, right across from the old Occupy. And if anyone remembers that, there was a gentleman who would walk up and down with a bullhorn every single day, shouting, "Lies, lies, lies, Lumumba, don't you cry, free all prisoners, free all political prisoners." And Judge King's court is on the 7th floor of that, and from the view from the window is really something I haven't seen before. City Hall, it looks a little diminutive, and the old camps look too geometrical or something. Friends and family, numbering about 10, were seated first, and press and the public took the other 50 seats. Jury selection had wrapped up in the morning, as you mentioned, Linda. There were exclusions based on one side of mistrust of the FBI, and on the other side, kind of a blatant mistrust of Somalis. On one extreme, a potential juror was excluded after suggesting that the FBI is basically in the business of entrapping people. And on the other side, another juror was excused after stating that Somalis were probably terrorists. So on both sides, there were exclusions, and, you know, we'll see what's left. And what was left was actually 13 plus three alternates. One alternate cut out after she found out she wasn't going to get paid for it. There are 9 women and 3 men, and there are, from what I can tell, 4 apparently openly non-white people.
And what was the prosecution's main point in their opening statement today?
Well, the government really started by setting the scene, and they started right at November 26, 2010, the day of the fake bomb scare at Pioneer Courthouse Square. The attorney really set the scene, thousands of families enjoying the day after Thanksgiving, and repeated several times that the defendant called the cell phone to detonate the bomb twice. The prosecution promises to show evidence that the defendant schemed for several months in order to bring this plan to fruition. Interesting that the prosecution anticipates the defense of entrapment, you know, and stated repeatedly that the defendant was radicalized, you know, way before any FBI contact. He had all kinds of writings. The attorney gave samples of his writings, which didn't sound good to me.
And so was it a fairly dramatic presentation for the prosecution, or?
Well, I don't know how to evaluate these things, but I thought it was going to be a little slicker, if that's what you mean. But, you know, she went on to, I think The idea of the opening statements is to outline a legal argument, but also really important in this case, to frame the story. She spent a lot of time doing that. She also anticipated the problem of missing recordings. If you're following the case, the FBI has got thousands of reels of tapes, but lost the first crucial one when they made first contact with it. She mentioned that, I think, bringing it up to anticipate any problems like that. She brought up links to extremist clerics. And she really seemed to emphasize the defendant's internet activism, because I guess that's where he was doing a lot of his writings on the internet.
So what about the defense? What was the main point that the defense was making? And tell us whether you think that, you know, how did you feel about the two arguments? How did you weigh them out? We've only got about a minute more.
Sure. Well, the defense started on November 9, 2009, and stated that, you know, Muhammad had just turned 18, and he had taken no action and made no statements of violence. And this is when the FBI first contacted him. The guy's name is apparently Bill Smith, and Agent Smith tried for months to get him to say violent things and do violent things. That attempt apparently failed, according to the defense opening statements. And the second attempt was basically an all-out attempt, and they really used heavy, sophisticated psychological techniques to lead him along. They praised his action. They invoked God. They used a technique called staging, where you get someone to do a task and give him a reward, give him a little bit of harder task. And he had gone through all these tasks. So I think on the defense side, they're saying he's a young kid. I think they made the statement, he's all talk and no action. I think he made that statement six or seven times. So I think that's where they're going. I think there's very little disagreement about the facts. No one's doubting. No one's saying he didn't call that phone. No one's saying he didn't do anything. No one's saying he didn't say terrible things. They're saying he would not have done that without the FBI.
All right. Well, this was Joe Meyer for KBOO News on the Muhammad trial going on in downtown Portland.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned now for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. Tonight on Bread and Roses, Leanne Krantz will discuss Aboriginal rights activism with two Canadian Indigenous writers. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. This weekend's weather, partly cloudy with temperatures in the high 30s.
It's 5:23, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Looking back at 2012, who was the nuttiest political fruitcake of all? Donnie Trump, Rick Santorum, and Newt Gingrich instantly come to mind, but they're pros at the nutball game, so naming them is unfair to some of the amateur talent that burst on the scene at year's end. For example, Wayne the Insane LaPierre. This honcho of the NRA came completely unwrapped during a December press conference. In a tremulous voice, the gun industry lobbyist delivered a rambling 25-minute tirade. He assailed anyone who suggests that the sickening assault weapon slaughter of six-year-old school kids in Connecticut should prompt us to ban those senseless weapons of mass killing. Rather, ranted LaPierre, the answer is more guns, turning American schools into armed fortresses. If that's crazy, Wayne concluded, then call me crazy. Yet, even Crazy Wayne wasn't 2012's top nut, for he was nipped at the last moment by a seven-man pod of nuts known as the Iowa Supreme Court. On December 21, this all-male court voted 7-0 to decree that, get ready to be whopper-jawed, a male boss may legally fire a female employee for no reason except that he finds her sexually irresistible. Try to get your mind around that. Even though she was not flirtatious, had no interest in him, and had been a stellar worker, she was ruled to be at fault, because the boss man can't control his lust. The learned men of the bench insisted that she was not fired because of her gender, but because of his feelings. So it was not discrimination, but merely an act by the boss to save his marriage. Another victory for family values. This is Jim Hightower saying, never mind that he was saving his marriage from himself, not from her. They say that justice is blind, but in Iowa, it's just plain nutty. For their supreme spasm of sublime nuttiness, we award 7 fruitcakes to the Iowa court.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
Tomorrow marks the third anniversary of the massive earthquake that devastated Haiti. The earthquake killed over 200,000 people and left nearly 500,000 without homes. 3 years later, 360,000 people remain without homes, living in makeshift refugee camps without clean water or food. Over half the aid money pledged by other countries and organizations has not been delivered as promised. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Dan Beaton from the Center for Economic and Policy Research, which has called on the U.S. government to take action to address the ongoing crisis in Haiti.
This weekend marks the third anniversary of the devastating earthquake that hit Haiti. Can you talk about some of the remnants of that earthquake that are still remaining 3 years later?
Really, the worst situation in terms of what's happened over the past 3 years, especially as a fallout from the international community's reaction to the earthquake, was that UN troops who have been in Haiti since 2004 actually started a cholera epidemic that's now killed almost 8,000 people, and it's infected well over 600,000. It's kind of tangential to the reconstruction effort, but it's related, and it's an ongoing emergency and one that the international community is not responding to very well. Another major one would be the housing situation, where you still have over 360,000 people estimated to be living in tent camps. These are people who lost their homes in the earthquake, and so that's really a pretty outrageous number to contemplate 3 whole years later.
So I know that initially the UN had denied that its troops were the cause of the cholera epidemic. Has there been an investigation then, and that's been proven that the UN is the source?
Well, there's been several scientific studies that say that the cholera strain is identical to the one in Nepal. The outbreak was traced to a location very close to where there was a Nepalese UN base. Journalists, including from the Associated Press, went to the base shortly after the cholera epidemic started and found that there was still waste contaminating the river from that base. So all those factors make it pretty clear that those UN troops were responsible. And even Bill Clinton, who these days works as a UN official, admitted that a UN soldier was the proximate cause of the cholera outbreak. So it's pretty clear that that's the cause, but the UN still officially is not taking responsibility for that.
The UN troops that are in Haiti are known by the acronym MINUSTA, led by Brazilian and Chilean soldiers. Why are they stationed in Haiti and have been since 2004?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, it's never really been quite clear. Officially, they went in after the Aristide government was overthrown to keep peace. I mean, that was their mandate in a nutshell, but there wasn't any real violent conflict going on then. And the violent conflict that did really begin in earnest began after Aristide was ousted, where you had people being killed in the streets by paramilitary groups, sometimes by the Haitian police, and sometimes when the Haitian police were killing people, there were MINUSTA soldiers right nearby. So really, MINUSTA was enabling this horrific political violence after Aristide's ouster, and they've just stayed there ever since, and, you know, there is some reason to think that they're there to kind of contain popular movements and to prevent people from rising up. I mean, they have cracked down on a number of demonstrations over the years, sometimes pretty violently.
Again, I've been speaking with Dan Beaton with the Center for Economic and Policy Research. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Today marks the 11th anniversary of the first arrival of prisoners to the U.S. prison camp at Guantanamo Bay. There, more than 160 prisoners continue to be held indefinitely, even though more than half of them have been cleared for release. Legal experts and human rights activists in Washington, D.C., observed the anniversary with a march to the seats of all three branches of government and called on President Obama to fulfill his promise to close the facility. Demonstrations were also held in Chicago, Dallas, Detroit, Los Angeles, Miami, and London to highlight the solemn anniversary. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Torture! Torture! Gitmo! Gitmo!
Outside the Supreme Court, a group of activists gathered to protest the Obama administration's failure to close the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay. The protesters, dressed in orange jumpsuits, also faulted Congress for reauthorizing the National Defense Authorization Act.
We say no way! We say no way!
Approved in December, the law bars the transfer of any Guantanamo detainee either to his home country or the United States. For the second year in a row, President Obama threatened to veto the entire bill over the Guantanamo Amendment, which he said infringed on his authority as commander-in-chief. Earlier this month, he signed it anyway. In drumming up support for the bill, South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham and other lawmakers made statements like this.
The people at Guantanamo Bay are not some kind of burglar or bank robber. They're bent on our destruction.
Yet several legal and military experts say Graham's claims about the detainees are far from the truth. Colonel Morris Davis was the chief military prosecutor at Guantanamo from 2005 until he resigned in protest in 2007. At a discussion in Washington on Friday, he said the U.S. government only has evidence against a small fraction of the detainees.
I mean, there have been, 779 people detained at Guantanamo that we were told were the worst of the worst. I mean, if you look at the ones that the government intends to prosecute, it's about 30 people total out of 779. So it's less than 5% that we even feel we can charge with a crime.
Nearly 90 of the remaining Guantanamo detainees have been cleared for release by the Justice Department, the Department of Homeland Security, the military, and the State Department. They include Uyghurs, Syrians, Tunisians, Palestinians, Yemenis, and one British citizen. Several lawyers representing those detainees came to Washington for the prison's 11th anniversary. One of them, attorney Thomas Wilner, said he hopes to combat myths perpetuated by some media outlets and politicians about who is incarcerated there and why.
Most people in the country believe Guantanamo is full of terrorists. In that context, their number